Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we're going to be speaking about kashrus of the home food establishment. You manufacture cookies, you sell them, you bake cakes for local simchas, and you do it out of your home. You're trying to supplement your income. Do you or don't you need a hechsher? I remember when I was a bachur or yungaman, I learned in yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. So the yungalite there were paid pennies. So there was a yungaman, his wife was a very good baker. She used to bake brownies. And outside the yeshiva, he'd have them like a little stand. And the bachurim who were starving for some good American bakery product would pay 50 cents for a brownie, and the younger man made a little bit of parnassa from it, and the bachram had what to eat. Did he need a hechsher? He didn't have one at the time. You sell cakes for the local, you know, and there's a simcha, they know you make the best seven-layer cake, whatever it may be. Do you need your home establishment need a hechsher? That's one question. And in general, we're going to be speaking about, to some of the leading mashgichim in the area, we're going to speak about, how do you know if a hechsher is a good hechsher or a bad hechsher? I mean, it comes stamped on a bag. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes. There are been many horror stories. Well, how do you know? We're going to have Reb Moshe Elephant, the chief operating officer of the OU, the largest kashrus organization in the world. I forgot how many hechsherim they give. It's tens of thousands of products. Huge staff, certainly one of the experts in the world on kashrus.
There was a person who was baking cakes in their home, a very popular person who is 100% a foreign person, and they bought a certain ingredient and that was not kosher. It had non-kosher glycerin in it. And they made an assumption that which is a very common assumption, what could be wrong with this ingredient?
He's going to actually wonder. He says, how do you give a hechsher at home? I mean, if there's a concept of mirsis that the person has to be afraid, he asks in his interview. He says, people don't think you're going to come barging into the house every night. We then interviewed Rabbi Shloima Pearl. He's the head of KCL, which gives many, many hechsherim for people who work at home. And he's going to speak about the reason for having it at home. And it's interesting. Rabbi Pearl is going to speak about not so much mirsis, but more about, you know, ignorance. He says, what happens if you're using products that you don't know that they're, you know, that they're kosher? He's going to say, somebody was using beef protein that wasn't kosher. I actually spoke to somebody who had for many years the KCL hechsher, and they said that KCL came once a year. And I asked them, I said, do you think once a year were you frightened? And they said, no, absolutely not. But they trusted us, which goes back to Eidecha Neman Bisurim. Then we're going to have from Brooklyn, Rabbi Baruch Steinfeld. He was the head of the Flatbush Kashrus organization that oversaw the Simchas and Kashrus, etc. Two very fascinating opinions.
In one of my places that we used to give hashgacha to was a store with multiple products. They ordered stuff and they sold it. And we would give hashgacha, not for every particular product, but we'd make sure that every product is under hashgacha. And if it's a part of the product, we would make sure that's an all part of plant, unless we made sure that hashgacha had a mashgiach kashering. We had certain guidelines set up. This owner was a Chassidus Yid, El Chiyid, as far as I know, and I would still consider him an El Chiyid. He would call me up sometimes and say, this and this product, could you do the research for me? Can I sell it in the store or not? I was once in the store with him straight there. This is why I'm saying this was in front of my eyes. And he asks me, I want you to find out about this product. But before you find out about this product, he opens up the package, he takes a bite out of it, and says, you know what? I'm not going to sell this in my store. This doesn't have good quality. But he ate it. So I asked him, Rav Yid, what's the shot? You ate this. You realize this could be paspalta, this could be chol stam. You ate this. He said, Hemachtzi. In my house, I would never bring any of this stuff in. I want my kids, Enikoch, to be Yireim and Shleim. This is business. I can't sell a product that's no good. I have to taste every product.
Before we go to our guests, I'd like to go through a few of the voicemails we had. So we spoke about 2 weeks ago about the mitzvah tans, and our question was that the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Chaf Aleph of Cotton Hay says that we don't embrace in public, you don't see Orthodox couples from a couples doing Dvarim Shal Chiba Barabim, and it's based on a Gemara in Baba Basra. The Gemara says Rav Bana went to the Maris HaMachpelah, and Avram Avinu, his wife was combing his hair. So he said he's allowed to do it even if Rav Bana is there. Why? Because in the Olam HaEmes, there's no Yetzahara. So then Muki Yosef says, it would seem from this, that if you're not in the Olam HaEmes, there is a Yetzahara, and it creates a Yetzahara for onlookers, bystanders to see it, and therefore we don't do Dvarim Shal Chiba Barabim. So we asked, or rather one of our guests asked, how could the Chassan and Kala dance together by the Mitzvah Tanz? So we had a few Chassidish Yungalite who responded, and here's one of them.
Rabbeinu Shmuel was Rav in Lodz. He had an Eidim, a son-in-law, There was a chusud, and Friday night when he came to L'chadoidi, he was clapping with his hands. His shver had a question to him. How can he clap with his hands if it says Shulchan Aruch they are not allowed? So his Adam said him a marvelous teretz. He said him like this. You know, when you do a mitzvah, it's gereiris to do another mitzvah. The same as the opposite, when you do an avera, it's gereiris to do another avera. One avera brings to do another avera. I want to see, after the chassidim clap with their hands, what avera do they do next? How will the davening look? How does the davening look afterwards? They do more and more mitzvahs afterwards, so it's not an avera. The same thing could be when a geya dancing chas and kala. I want to see, does chas and kala do an avera afterwards? What do they do afterwards? They do one of the biggest mitzvahs that says in the Torah. They're doing a thing of peri v'ribya. They're doing the biggest mitzvah that could happen for a couple. What it says, like the first mitzvah says, even as it says already in Pash Bereshis. So you're going to say that this goes against halacha? This will be an avera? So where's the next avera? I want to see it. It doesn't happen. Why? Elamai, it's a mitzvah. It doesn't shnim with Shulchan Aruch. That's your problem, not ours.
Now, this is an interesting argument, but look, this is a Torah program. We want to talk and learning. So I would tell this younger man, look, just this week's parsha, we have Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Le'yelecha Elohim Acherim. You're not allowed to bow to its Salem, right? And for thousands of years, Jews have died al Kiddush Hashem, not to bow to its Salem. During the Inquisition, it says they killed themselves for this, right? They killed their children, Rahman Litzvan. Now, you don't say, look, let's bow to the Tzalem, get past this bad moment, and then we'll all go back to yeshiva and we'll learn basmat. I mean, it's much better. We'll be able to stay alive and be serve Hashem. So there's a mitzvah coming afterwards. If there's a mitzvah coming afterwards, it must mean that what precedes it is muta. I mean, it's obviously an absurd argument. So we see halachically the concept that whatever you're doing must be muta, must be kosher, because it's followed by a divrei mitzvah or a dvar mitzvah or a life of mitzvahs is not a good argument. Right, that's how I would respond to this younger man. Now, here's another younger man. We'll only play a clip of it because the whole thing is in Yiddish.
Ah, if the stein is genoeg, ja, is de halloch is de kaboele. Geit me op die kaboele. Kaboele steken we halloch. Op die kaboele is du grootste zoide. Zoide is het geit voel wat met verstand.
Now, this younger man's argument is, it's Kabbalah. And since the halloch says we don't do it, but al pi Kabbalah, we do it, etc. And therefore, he says very emphatically, if it's sod, you're allowed it. That's why we do it, because it's sod, etc. So, here's how I would answer to this younger man, and I'm going to answer him in English, right? Because that's what our listeners listen. This is an old shaila. What happens when Kabbalah has one derech and halacha has another derech, right? This is not a new shaila. If you look as recently as the Mishneh Berurah in Siman Chaf Heis of Katan Membeis, brings a machlokes between the Zohar and the Paiskim, the Gemara and the Paiskim, whether you put on tefillin shal yad b'amida b'yeshiva. The Zohar says you do it b'yeshiva, and the Paiskim, the Gemara and the Paiskim say you do it b'amida. So the Mishneh Berurah already says over there, when there's a machlekes, the Zohar and the Gemara, we go after the Gemara. Nobody argues on this. When there's a machlekes, the Zohar and the Paiskim, then ready is a nidin. They say, you know, the Zohar is greater than the Paiskim. The Paiskim have a din of Rishonim and Achrayim, the Zohar has a din of Chazal. Right? So there's a nidin in the Paiskim. You know, if it's not in the Gemara, then do you go after the Paiskim? Do you go after the Zohar? Most of the Paiskim say you go after the Zohar. Now, there's another nidin if it's not in the, if it's not a Zohar, but it's Divrei Kabbalah, Lamashal, and Arizal. And does that Arizal have it negative the Paiskim? What do you do then? So there's all kinds of shilas. The Arizal Nechshev like one of the Paiskim. Is he not Nechshev one of the Paiskim? But it seems that almost everybody else, where I could see everybody holds, that is, if there's a Machlegis in the Gemara and the Kabbalah, everybody says you go after the Gemara. This din is Rav Bano. It's a Gemara in Baba Basra. It's not an Arizal. It's not a Zohar. That what that we don't show Chiba Barabim. So even if there's mitzvah tans, I don't know with the Makoyer, even if it's from the Arizal, it's not, it doesn't override a Gemara. Even if it's a Zohar, it doesn't override a Gemara. This is Ungenom in Kol HaPaiskim. And I'm talking about the Kaf HaChaim and Minchas Yitzchak, etc. The Chacham Tzvi, V'cholu, all of them say that. So this is a Beferishi Gemara. So it come back, it's good that it's Alpi Sod, but even if it's Alpi Sod, it can't be Doicha Gemara. So we need a better reason as to why a mitzvah tans would be mutter. And when I say a mitzvah tans, I don't mean when a rebbe is dancing with a gartel or a woman who's with a kala who's cloaked head to foot. I'm talking about what the chassid and kala are dancing, you know, hand in hand. Now, here's another few phone calls we had. We had a lady dating coach who said something. She said one of her worst stories or her, you know, in dating.
So in that case, it was a rav that she went to, that she was recommended from her friends to go to.
And what did the rav say?
you're getting engaged, it'll be fine. That was probably the worst dating advice. And the reason it was the worst dating advice was because he didn't know her from a hole in the wall till she went to him. And he never even asked to meet the boy or to see them together or asked her any pertinent questions about her relationship. He spent 2 minutes with her.
When you're telling somebody who to marry, it's dine nefashis. It's as close to dine nefashis as you're going to get as who's your marriage. Now, for dine nefashis, you need a bezdin shalchav gimel, and the bezdin has to have drisha v'chakira. So for somebody to say, yeah, you don't really like the boy, it's fine, trust me, marry him, without meeting the boy, it sounds like paskening, like I was like, kelachaya dine nefashis. It does sound rather strange. But here we have a caller who strongly disagrees.
Hello. I was just wondering how you said that you don't ask a Rav any shaylas that are not negated because he doesn't say it in the Shulchan Aruch. I was shocked. Are you saying such a thing? Amunas Chacham goes by everything. Amunas Chacham know by everything. Hashem gave them Ruach HaKadosh and they know by everything. You can't just say, oh, they don't know by Shidduchim. They're chutzpah. And you're a busha to call yourself if you say such a thing. That is busha.
So this gentleman was very opposed, and he seems to hold that it's like Ruach HaKodesh that his Rav had, and it's a gedra of Nevius of sorts, and therefore she had no right to talk disparagingly of this opinion. Ironically, like the next day we got a call that's exactly the opposite. Here's somebody who listened, and he really paid the price.
When I was about to get engaged, I think I got some very bad advice, and now I'm in a very bad position. I don't know if my marriage is going to last or not, but whether it does or doesn't, you know, I'm saying these are two bad options. As you mentioned on your show, divorce is not just turning back the clock and now you're back single and 22, you know. Whatever it is, the person's life is wrecked, whether they stay in a bad marriage or whether they get divorced. So I just wanted to say I'm very happy you raised awareness about this kind of thing. Whatever, you know, I wish I would have heard this kind of thing when I was dating.
So here's something interesting. When we were talking to this Bella Beer, who is the dating coach, we discussed, you know, what do you do in a situation you're dating and you don't know whether to go ahead or not? So I suggested that, you know, sort of you have to follow your heart in a way. Like, what's the, you know, it's not what this one says, what that one says. And if you look in the Ruach Chaim, in Ovis, Perig Beis Mishnah Zayin, Baruch Shekivanti, Imamish says this. He says on the Mishnah, Mar Be'etza, Marbitzfuna. The more advice you get, the wiser you get. So he says, Marbile bepumyudinshi. It's commonly said. It's a common aphorism. Sha'al etza, ask an etza, va'asei kesichlcha. Right, and then do like your seichel says. So he says, Lachura, if you're doing kesichlcha, if you're following your own intuition, why are you asking the etza? So he says, Ach yuvan pashet. It's simple. Ishmi bechutz, an outsider. La Yavin Kopnimiyas Inyan can't understand all the issues that you have, who you like, who you don't like, what your issues are with your parents. I mean, what goes into the psychology of deciding who you marry? I mean, an Eitzah like this, Rak Yavin Ma'at will understand a little bit. V'chein HaYoyetzah Sheini, and the second person you ask an Eitzah will understand a little bit. But the Noyetz Batz, by the person who's asking the question, who Mavin Lagamri Kopnimiyas Inyan, he understands it all. Aval Chasalei Seichel, he's missing perspective. Seichel Utzfuna Shal Kulam, he doesn't have that much wisdom. Al Kain, therefore, be covered Tetzvay Atzas Kulam, when he asks many people of advice. The Seichel Shal Kol Echad VeEchad, that way he says he'll weigh all these advice against his own intuition. He says, and that's what it means, Utshua Berev Yoyetz. The more yoyetzim you have, ultimately it'll allow you to make the proper decision. But ultimately, asei kesichlcha. That's the goyin. That's the Ruach Chaim in Pirkei Avos. And if you want to see almost the exact same thing, the goyin in Mishle, he says utshua b'roiv yoyetz. It's a Mishle. Utshua b'roiv with b'roiv yoyetz. He says, why doesn't it say b'roiv yoyatzim? Frek the goyin. Should say with many yoyetzim. He says no. It's many yoyetzim. But ultimately, you have to make the decision for yourself. And I would say the same thing about Shidduchim. I don't care who the advisor is and who it is. It could be the biggest psychologist, the biggest Rav. Ultimately, you're going to have to live with that person the rest of your life. So you listen and you weigh it. And what is the exact vart of the devotion of the Ruach Chaim, Mar Beitza, Mar Betzuna? Sha'al Eitza V'yasei Kesechacha. This is and he doesn't say, ask a gadol, ask a navi, ask a this, right? Neither the goyin nor the Ruach Chaim say this. They say, shal etza, from taka, from who? From a big rav, from a big yoyis, from a psychologist, from a dating coach, and then asei kesechacha. That's what it would seem to me from these two calls. Before we go to our shiur, I would like to talk about the parsha. And we have the Aseret HaDibros this week. And certainly, possibly, the hardest one of the Aseret HaDibros, and everybody has what they think, but generationally, I would argue is Lo Sach Moed. And why do I say that? We live in a world that advertising, I mean, even Jewish papers, pick your favorite Jewish paper, open it up, it's full of glossies, all the things that you don't have, but if you had it, you would be happier, right? Somebody else has it, they have it, but you don't have it. You would be happy if you had that. That's in the Jewish papers. Now go to the Goyish world. You have Madison Avenue. You have advertising. You have Facebook, which is, you know, became almost a $1 trillion company based solely off of advertising, as does Google, as does Instagram. And today, what's the most rapidly growing of these tech companies, the most valuable, is TikTok. TikTok has figured out how to create real jealousy, real envy into 30 seconds of watching. Here is somebody who can do something better than you. It could be food. It could be the way they look. It could be the way they dance. TikTok. TikTok as the anti-Lo Sach Moed, but it's really generational. So Lo Sach Moed is, I think most people recognize that comparison is the thief of joy. If you really want to be unhappy, no matter who you are, compare yourself to others. I remember years ago, I was in the office of one of the wealthiest men in the world. I was starting off in business. I brought him an opportunity, and he had in front of his desk a huge screen. It was here in New York. He was watching business news, and a competitor of his who was much more successful came onto the screen, and he had a box of tissues in front of him, the person I was visiting, and he picked it up, and he threw it violently at the screen. Because what does it mean? Competition is the envy of happiness, is the envy of joy. Well, we said it, but how do you do it? Like the Torah says, Lo Sach Moed, don't be envious of your friend's business, his house, his wife, his children, you name it. But how do we get to Lo Sach Moed? So what do our, you know, Balei Machshava say? Now there's a vart, it says, No et sefer b'tchilasei. You know, Bereshis is the first mimer, and the last mimer is Nasa Adam. Right, Saif Masa Machshava Tchila. The end of it all was for the Nasa Adam. The Aseret HaDibros, it starts with Anochi Hashem Elokecha. It ends with Lo Sach Moed. But it seems there's something in common with the Lo Sach Moed and the Anochi Hashem Elokecha. And I would say it as such, and I'm gathering from many years of, you know, learning, I would say that Anochi Hashem Elokecha says the Rabbeinu Shalom's Hoya Hoiva Viya Echad Yachid Miyuchad. He's one. I created, Rabbeinu Shalom says, I created heaven and earth. I took you out of Mitzrayim. I am the first, Ani Rishayin Vani Achrayin. The last one is Lo Sach Moed. And what is Lo Sach Moed? Lo Sach Moed is not that dissimilar. Bishvili, what does the Gemara say? Every person is Chayav Loimer. Bishvili Niver Olam. The world was created because of me. I am the one. I am a one-time event that will never be repeated. You know, this is the famous Reb Tzadik and Sidka Satzadik says it. Very clearly, he says, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, K'moy shechayiv adam lahamin ba'kadosh baruch Hu, just as a person has to believe in their kaviyachol, kein tzarech lahamin ba'atzmai, has to believe in himself, that he was brought here for a purpose, his own purpose, his individual purpose, nobody else has his mission. So what is it? The Aseret HaDibros start with, believe in kaviyachol. Lo Sach Moed is, believe in yourself. Believe in you. You, your mission, and the pasuk vayivaser Yaakov levadai, vayivaser Yaakov levadai, vayayavek ishimai. What does Chazal say? On the pasuk, it says, just like vayivaser Yaakov levadai, v'niskev levadai b'yayimahu, and kaviyachal, that just like kaviyachal was levadai, Yaakov is levadai. That bishvili, he reached a darga of bishvi nivroilam. Now, it says, Yaakov said to Esav, yeshli koil. I have everything. Whatever I need, I have. If I don't have it, it's probably because I don't need it. And what does it say right afterwards? V'yelech Yaakov l'darkei. But Yaakov reached a position where he realized, whatever I have, whatever I need, I have. I have my mission. I am levad. I'm not interested in anybody else's mission. I'm only interested. I'm levadai. And when a person reaches that madreka, yeshli koil, what does it say? V'yelech Yaakov l'darkei. He leaves Esav. What does Esav mean? Esav is the Satan, Esav is the Yetzirah, Esav is the Almalach, everything else. When a person could say, Yeshli Koil, I have what I need, then he could go, right? When he says, Vayivaser Yaakov Levadai, then it says, Vayelach Yaakov Ledarkai, he leaves Esav behind. When a person says, Yeshli Koil, it can upchepen from Esav, from all these Years ago, I had a story. It was a yid. His name was Reb Binyamin Eiser. He wrote the Evin Eiser on Shulchan Aruch. Right? He lived in the mid-1600s. Basically, he was the Daira II before the Baal Shem. Baal Shem was probably 10 years old or 12 years old when the Evin Eiser died. And he lived in a tiny town in Poland. I looked it up on Google Maps. I don't think it's big enough for a gas station. You know, it's like, and he was the rabbi of the town, and he obviously lived in great poverty or in simplicity. So, but he wrote shuvah, so he wrote letters, and they reached Berlin. And Berlin was looking for Rav, and one of the, you know, the kehillah there, they opened it up, a letter of his, and learning, and they, and the Gedalia kehillah decided this was going to be our Rav. And they traveled, it was like 400 miles, must have been quite a while, a week of travel to get to his town. And was called Klementov, a little tiny village in Poland. And they came to his town, this little village without the gas station, and they ask where he lives, and they point out this. And they go to his town, and they knock on this little hovel, and they come in, and he welcomes them. And it's three of the Rashi Hakol of Berlin. This is the largest community in Germany, which was, at that time, had more Yidden than Poland, right? Just the mid-1600s. And they unfurl this huge proclamation signed by the whole kehillah, inviting him to be Rav, and he listens. And they say, the story says, this is how he responded. He looked at them and he said, look, I live here. I'm the Rav of this little tiny town, and I have two goats in my backyard. One of them, we get milk and cheese. And the other one, my wife milks, and she sells it, and we have bread and a little chicken for Shabbos. He says, if I had a third goat, it would already be, I would be in Olam Haba. He says, you're showing me this beautiful home I'm going to have in Berlin, and the tzibur that I'm going to be, and the shiurim that I'm going to give, and the giant shul. And he says, I could just see all the tumult and the machlokes I'm going to have to be involved with, and making psharas between balabatim and community matters and overseeing hashirim. He says, I have everything. Why would I even want that? And he very politely told them no, and they made their 400-mile journey back then home. But the man with the two goats said, Yeshli Kyle. He didn't want to compare himself to anybody or to anything. He had true emuna that he found his mission. I know my mission. So what am I saying? I want to say something a little, I agree it's a little bit radical. If Reb Tzadik is right, Chayav Adam Lahamin, and we're saying the first of the Aseres HaDibros is belief in the Rabbeinu Shalom, Echad Yachad Umiuchad. And the next one is B'ta Adam, at the end of it, not Seifer B'tchilasei, it's Leisachmoid, you are a one-time event, and whatever your mission is, you know, the Rabbeinu Shalom knows, it's not meant to be compared to anything else. So, just like a person, Chas V'Shalom, no from a Jew would walk into a church. I would suggest that going on to TikTok or Instagram or Facebook to see how they are doing, not how I'm doing, but how the others, and comparing my tzura to somebody else's, because my mission is my mission, and I am not supposed to be comparing it. That's yours and this is mine. So going on to TikTok or Instagram for the purposes of comparison, seeing how they're doing, it's a little bit like going to church. It's being kaifer in the yechidus that you are, or that I am. Somebody told me that a cheetah, when it's chasing its prey, can go up to 80 miles an hour. It's the fastest creature in the world. But it expends so much energy that if it misses two or three times, it dies, because it burns up so much energy, it doesn't have the kayak to do that chase a third time. So when you see a cheetah chasing its prey, you could see the focus that it has. It has to catch it. It's not thinking about, does he think my kapata looks good, or my jacket looks good, or my shirt is wide enough, or if it's a she, does my dress look right? Do you think the cheetah's thinking about that when it's doing its two or three time? If it misses, it dies, or that intensity? We have our mission. Comparison steals joy. But even more than joy, it's a tumult us, and it contaminates who we're supposed to be and what our mission is supposed to be. It's like the yechidus in me is now going to church. And I think that's the answer to Leis Achmed. We all recognize how damaging it is, and you know what the answer is? I am me. I have my mission. It's a one-of-a-type mission. The Mesil Sesharim, all the way at the end of the Sefer, says, in your mission, you could be the simple tailor size 44 long or size 46 long? And he says, that mission is just as big as Moshe Rabbeinu's. That's what he writes at the end of the Masil Sisharim. He says, it's the belief in our mission, just like we believe in Anechi Hashem Alekecha. We believe, Chayiv Adam Lahamin Ba'atzma, if we believed I have my mission, and I'm disinterested, I don't care about the other one, at that point, it becomes a reality, it becomes easy, and it becomes something that we can actually accomplish. Is it difficult? Absolutely. Anechi Hashem Alekecha, Amun is also difficult. But here's a very short clip, a small interview, extremely inspiring, uplifting. A young girl, Rivka Shatkin, paralyzed a year ago in an accident, running, or rather wheelchairing, the High Lifeline Marathon. And listen to how she says how life is so beautiful. And you listen to this and you hear the cheering and her crossing the finish line. And you hear that and you say, wow, this is inspiring.
After a bad ski accident in 2021, NBC6's Victor Jorges is in Aventura with what this triumph means to her.
This is a moment Rivka Shatkin had only dreamt of.
While you're doing the marathon, it feels like it's never going to end. And then like crossing, it's like, oh my God, I did it.
Use those arms! Now she hopes to inspire others to live life a little differently.
We all like walk around like it's just like so difficult or something. Like it's not a gift to be here. And I think you should open your eyes a little bit, see how beautiful life is.
Joining us from Passaic, New Jersey is Rivka Shatkin, who just completed the Miami Marathon. It was spectacular. It made it onto national news. A real hero. Welcome, Rivka.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tell us your story about the Miami Marathon and how you got there and how exciting it was and what an accomplishment it was. Tell us the story.
Okay, so it started when 2 years ago I was in a skiing accident that left me paralyzed. And this past summer, I went to Camp Simcha, which is a camp for kids with disabilities and injuries and that sort of thing. And I was sitting in my bunkhouse, and my friend came in, and she said, let's do the Miami Marathon. I didn't know a thing about it, but I was like, you know, let's do it. It's a good way to give back to High Lifeline, who helped my family a lot. So we signed up the next day, and it just, I don't know, that's kind of how it started,
It's 13 miles in a wheelchair rolling. Like, how do you build up arm strength to that?
So it's my arms, like, just inevitably got stronger because they work as my legs now. So everything I do is with my arms. So I got really strong just because of that, because of the way I live. I didn't really get to train, so I don't know how I did it. I think it was really my friends and the people there, like cheering each other on. It gives you this boost and you don't want to stop. I don't know how I did it.
So was there a point in the, like, that you were just exhausted in the marathon?
It was more, I started exhausted, and then as I kept going, I more so wanted to prove to myself what I was capable of. Like, I didn't want to stop, because it was like, just do one more push, and every one more push, I would get farther, and it just kept going till I finished.
So what is your completion? What did it prove to yourself, and what could we learn from it?
It proved to me that I shouldn't create limits for myself. Like, I shouldn't decide that I can't do it because it hurts or because it's hard. Because as soon as you, like, realize it's not going to last forever, when you finish it, the satisfaction is going to be so great that I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to have that limited mindset that, oh, I can only do a certain amount because it might hurt. That was just
And what can we learn from it? What should we all learn from your completing it?
I think that you're really capable of so much. I think we all, it's almost subconscious, we decide we can't do something. And I think you have to more think about things and think, you know, I can do it if I really want to. Why am I stopping myself? Why am I creating this mindset or mentality that I can't do it?
That's fantastic. And when you were interviewed, I heard you spoke about how beautiful life is and how much you're enjoying life. Tell us about that.
I don't know where to start. I think lots of people just don't realize what a gift it is to be here, because life is so, so rare. And I think for most of us, we go by half our lives or maybe our whole lives just not realizing, like, to us, everything is so difficult and hard. but we forget to look at, like, the little things, the simple things. I've lost a lot of, like, the simple joys and pleasures of life that many people get to experience daily. But to them, it's like a burden. Like, walking up the steps, I watch people walk up the steps. To them, it's a burden. But to me, I want to get up and walk up the steps. So I think just appreciating everything that you have and that can so easily be taken away from you as soon as you realize, like, what you have, life becomes so much more beautiful.
Rivka, that was thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
You're very welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Let's go to our riddles of the week. Here's our first riddle of the week. Reb Itzel Aponovizhia was a Talmud of the Beis HaLevi. He was a Talmud of the Gadol from Minsk, lived at the end of the 1800s, mid-end of the 1800s. He was a Chavrusa of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik for a few years, as a young man, right? So in his Zecher Yitzchak, a Gaonish Sefer, he was also a Shiv in Slobodka. He was really one of the great Gedolim and Gaonim of his era. He asks a famous Shaila. He says, a Ger that comes to be Megayer, and he's a Chayla that he cannot do Mila. Could he be Mizgayer just with Tefillah alone? Whereas the crux of this Shaila is, do you say he's an Oinus and an Oinus is Pater? Or do you say an Oinus is Lav Kimanda of it? He could be an Oinus, but he still doesn't have the Mila and you need the requirements. It's like, if somebody's an Oinus and they can't get a driver's license, do you say, well, since he's an Oinus, let him drive without the license? Or do you say, look, we feel bad that he's an Oinus, but he still doesn't have the license? That's the Beulah, the Chakira of Rebetzela. And he goes back and forth with Rias. Now, a question on Reb Itzel is, and this is a very well-known Shaila, the Gemara says here, Rav says, that Yisrael, who comes before Matan Torah, is the first Ger, he's Mol Atzmai Lehisgayer, he'd committed Mila, performed Mila to be Megayer. The Shaila is, the Gemara says in Yevamos, that the 40 years that Kal Yisrael was in the Midbar, they didn't mal themselves. Why? Because of Chulsha the Urcha, or because there was no Ruach Tzvainis, because it was a Sakanus Nefashis. And they didn't mal themselves, which would mean that Yisrael should be Potter. And yet you see that he had to be mal himself to be able to be Megayer. He had to enter in. So how could the Zecher Yitzchak Kler, somebody who's a Sakonist Ager who can mal himself, because it's a Sakonist Nefashis, should be Potter from Mila? Why? Because Mila, if you don't have it, the Tefillah alone is good. You see from Yisrael that the Tefillah alone wasn't good. Yisrael was in that exact position, and yet he was required Mila, because you see, Mila, it's true you're an Oinus, but Oinus is Lav Kimanda of it, and you still don't have the Mila. That is our Kasha on Reb Itzel Aponovizhia, Chavrusa Reb Chaim, Rashiva Slobodka, great Goyin of his era. Here's another fabulous riddle, and this riddle was from, Yankiv Kamenetsky brings it down to Shaila, and he brings it in the Emes LeYakev in Zvachim. And it's Kasha that he heard from Reb David Rappaport, who wrote the Migdash David, the Tzemach David. He died with, he died, Hashem Yakum Damai, in World War II. He died without children. All we have left is his Torah. So, Bishav Saisav Dovos Bekever, we'll see over the Kasha. He's Reb Yankiv says that while they learned together in Koil and Kovna, by the way, the Migdash David, you may not know, was also Rosh Hashiva in Baranovich, together with Reb Elchanan. So he says, while we learn together in Kol Kovner, Reb Yankiv says, he asked me a kasha. What was the kasha? Rashi says, here in the parsha, Mizbeach Adama Tasali. So Rashi says, Mizbeach Adama Mechubur Ba'adama has to be attached to the earth. You can't be built Loyal Gabe Amudim on poles, Loyal Gabe Kipim, not in type of like tunnels. Has to be exact, anchored into the earth. What's he saying? The Gemara says in Parah that Harabayis Vazora, they had like a cholol beneath them because of Kever HaTahayim. They didn't want any Tumah to be Ela. So they made a hefsik with a cholol that was a tefach. So it seems from Mizbeach Adama Tassali, Rashi saying that the Mizbeach was not built Al Gabe Kipim, but what? It was built directly Al Gabe HaAdama. By the way, the Rambam, Taka says that the whole Harabayis had a chol tachtav. Rashi saying, excluding the Hadama, correct the Mikdash David, that the Gemara says, in Zvachim and Afsamach Beis, Rebbe Lezer ben Yankiv says, Gimel Nevi'im, three Nevi'im they brought up from the Gaila. When Ezra came from Bavel, he brought three Nevi'im. Why? To be able to testify where is to be able to snabe and where is the Makim HaMizbeach. The Makim HaMizbeach here, do what Ram says, Medugdik Ma'oid Ma'oid, had to be very exact. They had to know where the Mizbeach is. Frek de Migdash David, what was the problem? According to Rashi, the entire Azara was built al gabe kipim. The only place that's not built al gabe kipim was the Makam HaMizbeach, because it's Bechubr L'Adama. Look for the place in the Azara that has no kipim. That's where you would make the Mizbeach. What do you need to Gimel Nevi'im? This is the kasha that the Migdash David asked Rabbi Yankiv Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadikim Levracha, in the Kavanah Kailul. Those are our two riddles. If you want to leave a message by phone or dial in by phone to listen, in America our number is 732-806-8700. In England it's 44, that's the country code, 33-011-70250. In Eretz Yisrael it's 02-372-0304. Let's go to our guests.
Joining us from New York is Reb Moshe Elefant. He's the Chief Operating Officer of OU Kosher, largest kashrus organization in the world. He also says one of the largest Afyami Shirim in the world, and online that is. He also is the Rav of Kal Zichron Yosef. Welcome, Reb Moshe.
Shalom Aleichem.
Reb Moshe, Kol Kaira came out recently, well, it wasn't that recent, about home establishments. People who make products at home and sell them. And it says they absolutely need a hechsher. Can you walk us through your opinion about that?
I think that it's a very critical and important and statement. And it's a very complicated because, of course, we know that we're dealing with people's parnasa. There are people who make a living from baking or other products that they prepare at home. And if they don't have a hechsher, obviously people will not buy their products. And that's not something we take lightly. People's parnasa, but kashrus, as far as kashrus is concerned, giving hashgacha on a product that's manufactured in someone's home is something that I can't see how it could be done. The basis of kashrus is mirsis. The basis of kashrus is that why don't we need to have the OU certifies 14,000 facilities around the world? We don't have a mashgiach in every facility. Why is that not halachically required? And the answer is because we could walk in contractually, we could walk into any facility at any time, day or night, as long as they're open, they have to let us in. And that creates a mirsis. However, you can't walk into somebody's private home any time, day or night. That's one very big halachic issue. The second issue is a practical issue. A factory, by definition and by nature, is a place that knows that they need to produce X amount of chocolate chip cookies. To manufacture chocolate chip cookies, you need flour, you need sugar, you need chocolate chips, whatever you need, and you have it prepared. And if you run out, you can't just run down to the grocery down the block and buy some oil, because you're not buying one or two jugs of oil. You're buying oil in totes, hundreds of gallons. That you can't get in your corner grocery store. But when you're making product in your own home, there, you're not, even if you're Baruch Hashem successful, you're not using that volume of ingredient. And if you run out of ingredient, or as people who are in that business tell me, they get calls that Baruch Hashem, somebody had a simcha, is having a simcha, and they get calls Friday afternoon, we're making a kiddush, and we need porter, cake, or whatever, or caterers for the same matter. I recently met a caterer who told me the strength of his business is that he's able to prepare a simcha in the last minute. And he could get a call Friday afternoon that I want to make a kiddush tomorrow, and he will have a kiddush for you. That's fantastic for him, and maybe for his business, but from a kashrus perspective, that's a potential catastrophe, because where is he going to get all of those ingredients on such short order on a short Friday? Those are my two main issues.
Okay, so let's debate this, okay? The Shulchan Aruch Kuf Yud Tes says that if somebody's a muchzik b'kashrus, he could have a store,
right? And the Ravid says, the Vaisesi says, you don't even have to be a muchzi b'kashrus, but you're not a chashid on kashrus, you could buy from the person. So this is clearly not Vaisesi, Ramah, Shach, Taz, etc., right?
But you're also, I'm certainly well aware of the Takana Devar Abba Harotzis that says that even if you're a muchzi b'kashrus, or as you correctly point out, the Beis Yosef is even more lenient. As long as you're not a chashid, the Vat Abba Rotzis already came out with a takana that anybody who owns a business needs a hechsher. And the reason for it is that you are muchzah b'kashrus, but there are nisyonis. And that's why they made that takana hundreds of years ago, that everybody needs a hechsher, even though the Shulchan Aruch and the Shach and the Taz, as you correctly indicate, say that if you're muchzah b'kashrus. And that's why if that very same person who I don't want to give a hechsher to invited me to their home for dinner tonight, and they're reliable people, the muchzah b'kashrus, erechonem b'surim, I would be allowed to eat. And I would eat. But just because I'll eat in your house doesn't mean I'm going to give you a hechsher.
Well, so the question is, was the vada arba ratzis, the skabel everywhere? I mean,
absolutely.
You say absolutely.
I haven't seen anyone who said that.
I have. I'll give you a few marmakaymas. For starters, Reb Chaim Kanievsky, and Asifas Yitzchak Chafel Tavshin Samachayin says the Darkei Tshuva brings the Takanas Arba Ratzis, right? Can do you or don't you? Tshuva Haminig the Bemuchzik Kainim. Not like the Darkei Tshuva.
Rabbi Avigdon Evansol,
and Asifas Yitzchak Zayna, same Shaila, he says Lanier's Daiti Mutter. That was wasn't a Skabel. Right?
Okay. As far as I know, it was Meskabel. And I have to tell you, not that I am Chas v'Shalom, the one to dispute not Rav Chaim Kanievsky and L'chadu Bechaim L'chaim, Rav Nevensal Shlita, but I could tell you, you know, one of the complicated issues in Kashrus is that people try to differentiate between Shomer Torah Mitzvahs and individuals who are not Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, based on what you're saying. But we've had enough situations with people who are Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, A, and B, the pressure...
Wait, but slowly, but respectfully, Rabbi Elson, we've had situations where with Hechsherim, you've had disasters.
Does that mean we shouldn't lock our car because even locked cars have been broken into?
But that's not the point. The point is that
the point of the Hechsher is to do the best we can. Does a Hechsher guarantee that nothing will ever happen?
I don't disagree with you.
The Hechsher doesn't guarantee anything, but it certainly helps. If your car is locked, does that guarantee that it won't be broken into? Of course it doesn't guarantee. But if there's two cars parked next to each other, and one is open and one is locked, which is the car that's more likely, and they're both the same model, that whoever's looking for it is going for it, which is the car that's more likely going to be broken into?
So my question to you is, if you're correct, why wasn't the Gemara, the Rambam, the Beis Yosef, the Ramah, the Shach, or the Taz come up with your solution?
First of all, there is a concept of hashgacha that's not new in the world. So, and the world was a different world. We didn't have ingredients that were coming from China when I came to the OU 35 years ago. So we're not talking back the time of the Gemara and the time of the Rambam. We're talking in our lifetime. Ingredients were primarily sourced locally. It was a whole new world. The world changed, and the issue of non-kosher ingredients, there weren't the kind of factories that are refining kosher oil and non-kosher oil.
Great point. So my question to you then is, since ingredients are so complicated and they're sourcing kosher and non-kosher in the same factory, can you eat by your friend's house or not, given that ingredients are so complicated?
So you have to know what are your friend's standards.
So I'm saying, if your friend is a muchzik b'kashrus, can you eat in his house or not?
Yes, because...
So can that same person then...
You don't have to ask about your friend. You can ask about your own house.
Agreed.
How are you at home tonight?
Agreed.
You trust your wife, and you've given her your expectations, and she tells your expectations.
Exactly. So she's buying the ingredients that you would accept. So based on that, can I then buy from that person, even though there's oils that are made in two different sources, because that person will buy the correct in the correct source.
My wife is not under pressure. And if she wants to make something for dinner tonight and she doesn't have any ingredients, if she doesn't have the ingredients that she needs, either she'll go to the supermarket and find the ingredients with the hashgachas that I'm comfortable with, or she'll make something else for dinner. That's my... We don't have to have...
Let's say my wife is making a bas mitzvah, and there's a lot of pressure. Could I eat by the bas mitzvah, say, maybe
it's
my wife caught standards and bought something trace?
It's still not the same as a caterer. Your wife's reputation is not on the line if this dish will or won't be at the bas mitzvah. You know what? You're preparing, your wife intended to serve A,
okay,
and it wasn't available. The caterer, who I ordered the dinner from, and I sat and worked on the menu, is going to have to provide what I made. His panosa, his livelihood,
agreed,
is on the line.
I agree with that.
Your wife's livelihood is not on the line if she doesn't make what she thought she wants to make.
Agreed. So then why didn't the Gemara, the Rishayim, or the Shulchan Aruch make that
call? Maybe it was a different world. I told you.
The Gemara is talking about storekeepers in Syria. You have to assume storekeepers then have the same Rishayim as today. They have to keep their shelf stocked.
Of course not. There was no trace for ingredients yet.
The Gemara says you can't buy from storekeepers in Syria because they're going to substitute trafe ingredients, right? That's what the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, right?
I can't tell you why a Gemara doesn't say something.
No, I'm saying the Shulchan Aruch. I'm just saying.
I can't answer a negative. I only can answer a positive. I can't answer why the Gemara didn't say.
My only point is that these cases, the Shulchan Aruch does not require Hesha, and it's the Beis Hillel who brings it in, who says it's Tatakana's Vada Arba Ratzis, and the question we're just discussing was the Vada Arbarat, is it Niskabel in the whole world or not?
As far as I know, it was Niskabel,
okay,
and not that they need my Haskama. Our experience is that it should very much be Niskabel, because even when you're a reliable person, there are Nishinus, and it's not just Nishinus, because I don't want to turn people into being dead, because that's not fair. What I really mean to say is that there's also ignorance. So the person goes to the store. Just yesterday, somebody sent me an email, and they said they just bought Stella Dora cookies, and they're sure it's Pass Yisrael. I said, why are you sure that Stella Dora cookies are Pass Yisrael? He says, because I bought them in a store in Bar Park, and a store in Bar Park would not be selling cookies that are not Pass Yisrael.
Right.
That happened yesterday afternoon.
So you shouldn't be eating
before
that person's house.
On the program.
You shouldn't be eating by that person's house either, then.
Of course not. You shouldn't be eating that person's house. The point is, the people, that's the job of Hashgacha, that we do know, and they don't know necessarily.
So bottom line is, and by the way, another Mara Makam I'll just share with you. The Oyel Yaakov brings from Rabbi Zriel Leibach, that young Goliath who sell cake in yeshiva.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, he says, if you know, ba'ifen ishi esamuva shumursik bekashrus liknas yemenu machelim v'chein hayrolei hagoyin or psaria davlitsky from Bnei Brak. Let me ask you a question. You're in Hong Kong, one of these faruktim akimis, you're traveling, and there's no kosher food, but the Chabad will send you over suppers for $20. They do it for a minimum fee, right? Could you eat it or not?
Do they have Hashgacha or not?
They don't. It's in Hong Kong. There's no, her husband is the Mashgiach.
The husband is the Mashgiach. I would say no, unless you go down to the house and you can make yourself comfortable. I would not buy it. I would say I have to go down and make myself comfortable. Otherwise, not.
Well, I don't know how you would eat it in anybody's house. Or...
All right. So you know what? If you want to do it right, you do it right. There are too many shaylas of people who make assumptions that we afterwards learned that those assumptions were very dire. There was
a story. I have a question for you.
I want to tell you something years ago, where before this Kol Kairi came out, and maybe even before anybody contemplated the Kol Kairi, where there was a person who was baking cakes in their home, a very popular person who is 100% a fine person, and they bought a certain ingredient that was not kosher. It had non-kosher glycerin in it. And they made an assumption which is a very common assumption, what could be wrong with this ingredient? And therefore, since they made an assumption, what could be wrong with this ingredient?
What was it? You know the ingredient? You know what it was?
Yeah, it was icing on a cake.
They assumed that icing can't have nothing trace in it?
What could be icing? A little sugar and color. That was their assumption. Maybe a fair assumption. It could be sugar and color. What's wrong with sugar?
I would just say that most housewives, Froma housewives, are not buying icing without Hersha.
Okay, but this is not a Froma. It was not just a Froma housewife. It was actually a Froma. It was a Froma housewife that was baking cake, not just for her family, but for a lot of people else.
Look, there's no suffix that people could make mistakes out of ignorance. But the question then is, the Gemara says, Ei dechanan min bisurim. Rashi says, therefore, you're allowed to eat by your own house. So the question is, if your wife is ignorant, she was not a stellar student at school, right? Are you allowed to eat at home or not? Because you could make so many mistakes. And the Gemara says, Ei dechanan min bisurim. We assume that she's doing reasonable things. You told her you buy with a heksha, you this or that. And that's the whole, you said, Rashi says, otherwise, Ei nadam oichel oitzel chaveri adam, eitzel de misachsen oitzel chaveri adam, oichel oitzel ishtai, right? So your point is that when you're doing it in mass, we should have a different level of comfort.
No. I don't know if the taich of Erech Nam Bisur means, since I know that you're from Jew, I can eat in your house. I think Erech Nam Bisur means that I know that you have the standards, you have the standards and the knowledge to make me comfortable to be able to eat in your house.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, Rashi says, watch the svara that Eid Echadam and Bisarim, Rashi Nivamas, because if not, I think it's up Teches. He says, otherwise, Eina is a Mesach said Eitzel Chavera. He says, how would society function if you can't believe
but
people?
But Rashi doesn't define, that. Nobody's disagreeing that Rashi says that the world needs it to survive. But Rashi doesn't just say, so since you're from, I could eat by you. If you're from and you're Amoritz, I could eat by you. You're from and you're not Maritz, and
well,
you think
that Maritz would have a din of a chashid. That's what he would have a din of a chashid on it, because he doesn't know.
Okay, so what's the definition of Maritz in this subject? In my mind, the definition of Maritz is somebody who's not knowledgeable in what's going on in the world of kashrus, somebody who's not knowledgeable which products need a hashgacha.
But you know, so I'll tell you something. I spoke to a number of rabbanim, and they said very modern Chrysler or Bali Tshuva Chrysler, and they said that one of the number one questions they get is which Hechshit you could use and which Hechshit you can't use. So the assumption is most Frumma wives know that the OU is a good Hechshit. You know, they know that the Star K is a good Hechshit. They know that the Chav K is a good Hechshit, et cetera, et cetera. That's the assumption. That's how the assumption how people eat at home, too.
Absolutely. But that doesn't mean, so that it goes back to my earlier point. Your wife knows which hashgachas are good, whether it's because you told her or she knew before she married you, or maybe she told you. That's perfectly fine. But your wife doesn't have the nesiyinus that a person who's running a business does. Even if your wife is making a simcha, she's not locked into a menu. She's controlling what's going to be served. And she's an eidechanam bisurim, and that's why it's different. A person who's doing this for money, and I think that's the shot behind the takanasvara abaratzis, where there's a financial factor involved, people make decisions that are not always the correct decision. Not that they want to serve you something that's not kosher. I don't believe a frumma yid wants to serve you something or sell you something that's not kosher. And if there are cases like that, I agree with you, they are exceptions, not the rule. But there are different situations where people start being Meir Het and start rationalizing because they have their livelihood on the line. That's the reality.
I mean, the washing of the washing of the Beis Hillel is, he says, light plug. You're not going to know who is a Mokshar and who isn't a Mokshar should if they made light plug.
Whatever it is, a financial incentive, light plug.
But he doesn't say that. I'm just saying you're being...
What he means. I think that's why he said it needs a Hechshar. He didn't say about your house. The Beis Hillel didn't say that a house needs a Hechshar. The Beis Hillel said a business needs a Hechshar. Why did the Beis Hillel distinguish between a house and a business? Because whenever there's a financial incentive, it changes the picture.
Or it could be that your friend, you know, he's a Mokshik Bekashras. A store owner, it's less likely.
You can know the store owner a lot better than the guy that invited you in shul. You walk into shul and somebody who looks religious invites you for dinner. You don't know him at all. The person in the store could be a person that you know very well. He could be a close relative.
He says that's only because of light plug. You usually don't know the store owner that well.
So I think that the light plug means financial incentive versus not financial incentive. The person who's inviting you for dinner has no financial incentive. The person who has a business has a real financial nesoyin. And the nesoyin is not
the light plug. What is the lush light plug?
Anybody who's doing it for business.
So it's not light plug. It's because of financial incentive. It's not a
light plug.
But that's the light
plug. So everybody has to have a hechsher. You'll say, why does everybody have to have a hechsher? Moshe Rabbeinu needs a hechsher. So light plug. I don't start deciding you don't need a hechsher because you are David Lichtenstein, but Moshe Elfin needs a hechsher. Everybody who has a business needs a hechsher. That's how I always understood Beis Hillel.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a few more questions. So you wouldn't eat in anybody's home then, even Chabad Chassid, the Gemman buying, et cetera.
I didn't say a home. I said a business.
Where they're selling it
if they don't have a hechsher.
Yeah. Correct.
I tell people I have a small shul, so it's not really, really a raya. But I've discussed this with Rabbanim who have big kehillos, and I've explained to them why they should make a rule that everything should have a hechsher. And some of them have, in fact, after we've discussed it, called me and said, Rabbi Elfin, we've thought about it, and we have now made that rule. I'll tell you an episode that happened to me. When I married off my daughters, we made Shavuot Brachos in a hall in Borough Park. That's where I live. And the hashgacha on that hall is somebody who is a colleague, somebody I work with in the world of kashrus. And he has a rule that everything that comes into the hall has to have a hechsher, or if it doesn't have a hechsher, it has to be made in the hall. So now what happened was that my wife wanted to serve salads. And the salads, as you know, are expensive. And my wife said she, her sisters, want to prepare salads at home. Now, I would consider myself a reliable person. Let's not debate that, okay? And my wife said, I'll use only the companies of Czech vegetables that you, Rabbi X, are comfortable with. And he said to me, I won't let that into the hall. I know you very well, Rabbi Elfin. I have a lot of confidence in you, but the rule is that everything has to have a hechsher. And I respect that. And I accepted that.
I'll tell you how I wanted to make a chilek that I thought was a chilek, right? Because I think people who are traveling or guys in yeshiva, I think that you see in the poskim already in Afkamina, from eating in somebody's house or from eating in a store, right? In a store, you need a muchzik b'kashrus, let's say, according to the Rambam. To eat in somebody's house, eidech anamim b'yisurim. You don't have that extra thing of muchzik b'kashrus, right? And what's the svara that the Gemara says, the Rishonim say? Because what he sells, he himself is not going to eat treif. But to give it to the other person, he's not so makbid already on Yenna. You know, Lifna Iver is not makbid on his own kashrus, and therefore in his house, the person who's chashid, and you can't eat in the store, in his house you could eat. That's what the Shulchan Aruch paskins, right?
Mm-hmm.
A gavurcha, very ironic thing. I was asked, remember there was the big scandal in Muncie, the Muncie butcher?
Oh, yeah.
So somebody asked me, what do you think he ate at home? And I said, it's a Beferish Machaba. At home, he ate kasha. He didn't care about other people, but at home, he wouldn't. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says in Kufiyot Tes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I said the following svara. I said, to me, once you accept that you need a hashgacha, like the Vada Arba Ratzah says, it doesn't matter if it's in a home, it doesn't matter if it's in a store. A store, a home factory is just a store factory that's looking for cheaper rent. Right.
Very good. Well said.
Right. However, if the person is using in her own kitchen and she's using her own kalim, so here she's not going to want it. This whoever this is, this housewife is not going to want it. Is not going to want to trace it up their own kalim, right? So if they're using their own kalim, she has a cake. She bakes 3 cakes a day for her husband. She bakes for the 2 of the 10 people who come to town. So it's going to be mutter. If, however, it's a home bakery, in other words, you go into the basement and they have it's a business operating out of a home. A business operating out of a home is no different than a business operating out of a store, except it's cheaper rent, right?
Nice sorrow. I like your sorrow.
So based on that, would you accept to say, look, if the woman's baking in her house, she's using her own kalim, and her husband is selling a few cakes in shul, or for the person who comes to town, they also provide their dinner, and for the people who come to town, dinner. That, to me, it's an extension of what they do at home. It doesn't have a dinner.
I would accept the sorrow. I think it's a sound sorrow, but it doesn't answer my concern about 2 things. Number one, about what's their level of knowledge, because again, it's not the same as
it boils down to you. Would you eat supper by that person's house?
They don't have the nesayin. You and I and they don't have the nesayin of what's going to be with the order that I have to fill. These are the realities of the order.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm telling you, Svara, even if they have to fill an order, they're not going to want to trace it up their own kalim. That's what I'm saying.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But usually they don't use their own kalim because you don't need a big pot to make dinner for your family.
Yeah, but the same pot that they're making for that, they're probably making for their family too.
Okay. If that's the case, that you could verify that they're making a big pot of soup and they're taking off soup for their own family and the rest of the soup is what they're selling, I think it's a sound svar.
Okay, so there are hundreds of hechsherim, right? How do you know what to rely on? I mean, we have, unfortunately, biggest scandals with hechsherim we've had recently than we've had ever had with somebody at home. So how do you know which hechsherim to trust and which not?
You know, the question is a fantastic question, and it's something that I think about a lot. And I'll tell you how I think of the question. If somebody, chas v'shalom, needs a doctor, okay? he's not feeling well, and whatever, everybody should be gesund und stark, but we know that people need doctors. Do you know anybody that needs a doctor, certainly for something which is serious or semi-serious, will just open up the Yellow Pages? I don't know if they have Yellow Pages anymore, but will just open up the Yellow Pages and look up, I need a cardiologist. They'll look up on the list of cardiologists and just call anybody who's there. Do you know anybody that would do that?
No.
I don't think anybody responsible, certainly nobody from the Jewish community, is going to do that, right?
Yeah.
And so in my mind, for a doctor, you would never rely on a doctor, even if he sends you a copy of his license and his diploma, just because he's a doctor. So just because somebody created a symbol, figured out a way to embellish the letter K and created a symbol, why should you trust him? I don't have an answer to your question. I think that just like you wouldn't go to a doctor without checking him out, you shouldn't eat from a
doctor. I'll tell you the difference. I'll just tell you the difference, okay? A doctor, you know, I had a sister of mine went to a dentist. He drilled and he hit a nerve, and now his one ear is she could barely hear from it.
Nothing.
And she said, then she asked, she says, oh, she heard a few people who are terrible with this. When you're buying a Hesha, you have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. I had on a Hesha from Eretz Yisrael. I had on a Hesha. So your average consumer has no idea. They never interact. It comes and shows up on the supermarket.
But, you know, there used to be a store famous statement that educated consumers the best.
So I'm asking you, how do people check out? You have
so
a scandal with this Hesha. Scandal with this. Well, how do you know? Is it a good Hesha that had a scandal, or is it a lousy Hesha, right?
You know what? I don't. You know, it wasn't the OU that had that scandal. So it would be very easy for me to say, yeah, don't use that Hesha. But that's not what I'm going to answer. What I'm going to say is every person in consultation with his Rav, in the consultation with Talmid Chachamim, should have certain questions that they need to know and then they need to have answered before they trust the Hechsher. I'll tell you a story that just happened a couple of weeks ago. I was invited to speak at a certain Yarchi Kala, a very chashuv Yarchi Kala, 270 Balabatim, who took off 2 days just to sit and learn. Mikam Chisrael. And I was invited to come speak Sunday night together with another Rav at that Yarchi Kala.
I'm curious. What's so good? Did you speak about?
My sugyas kashrus. My sugyas are daf yomi and kashrus. So first I gave daf yomi shir, and then I gave, we spoke about kashrus. Those are my subjects. People don't call me to talk about heart disease. They call me about the subjects I know. So that was my shir. So we're speaking about kashrus, and I said, l'anias daiti, that any store, any food establishment that is preparing meat, or is preparing food where there's a real nisoyan and a real incentive to cheat, because the cost of kosher meat is double the cost of non-kosher meat, and the availability of kosher meat is not there like the availability of non-kosher meat, needs to have an independent Shomer Shabbos individual in that store. That's my opinion. I know we may be able to debate that, but that was my opinion, and I said to this audience, which, as I repeat, was a very, very chashuva audience, that if you walk into the store and you don't see such a person, you should walk out. And the fact that the store has a hechsher, and it doesn't make a difference in my mind who is the hechsher, doesn't make a difference. You should walk out. That was my statement. I thought it was a fair statement. It certainly reflects my opinion. What happened was, I got a call a week or 10 days after I spoke there. Do you know how people were upset at your statement? I said, I didn't know. I was not part of the audience. I was part of the panel. But I said, you people, how dare you say that? I said, listen, you could say how dare I say it, and you don't have to agree, but I still stick to my opinion. And what I'm saying in answer to your question is, the fact that somebody's name or somebody's certificate is hanging on the wall, so what does that mean? What does that mean? To me, it means that you're a cardiologist. That's all it means. But it doesn't mean that I could trust it. That I would go to you. I would put my life in your hands. And machalsa surus, I'm a tamtim de life. It's the same life. It's yiruchnis de life.
So bottom line is, you're saying you have to, the kosher consumer has to be curious. He just can't accept what's hanging on the wall. If something doesn't smell right, he has to.
I'll tell you a great story that happened when I was a young boy. It was a long time ago. I was in Eretz Yisrael together with my father, Oliver Shalom, and my mother had a great uncle who was a very chashuv rav, who lived in Tel Aviv. We were there. It was a Shemitah year. And the Shemitah in those days doesn't look like Shemitah nowadays. Nowadays, you go to Eretz Yisrael during the Shemitah, you can't really tell. You go to the hotel, you get the same fruits and vegetables like you got during the non-Shemitah years. In those days, people who were machmer in Shemitah were limited. They didn't have all the fruits and vegetables, and they certainly weren't the quality that people were used to. We came to Tel Aviv, that's where this uncle Rav lived, and the stores had the most beautiful fruits and vegetables. So my father, Oliver Sholem, asked my uncle, how is that shaykh? So he says, you know, het mechira, whatever. So my father says, the het mechira has Rabban, asks this person, the het mechira has Rabban behind it, so it should be good enough. So I was a young boy, and I said, would you eat if there was a suffix on something had poison, that it was poisonous? And there was the slightest percent chance that it was poisonous, but somebody reliable, somebody, a Rav, said it's not poisonous. Would you eat it? Of course not. I, the person, said it's not. You don't take chances with your life. The same thing is Machalos Asuros. Machalos Asuros are Metamtim Libei Shaladim. We don't even really clearly understand what that means. But it certainly doesn't sound good. So you don't take chances with that. And just saying because somebody signed their name on it and created a symbol, so that's good enough for me, but you're Metamtim Libei Shaladim. You don't know what that could bring.
Okay. What questions should a person ask?
So in my mind, the first question a person should ask is when we're dealing with retail. Is does the place have an independent Shomer Shabbos person there all the time? That's the first question.
Even if it's from a person who owns it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's the first question that I believe one should ask. Next question is, you should ask, who are the Rabbanim? You can't know that. You can't ask a question about every factory. Or you're going to ask a question about all 14,000 factories that we certify. But you should try to learn who are the people who are responsible for that Hechsher. Who are they? What are their qualifications? Who are their Paiskim? These aren't such hard questions to ask. And check them out. Check out who are the people who run the OU and find out if you think that they're reliable people, if they're Talmid Chachamim, if they're people who know what they're doing, do they have Paiskim, who are their Paiskim? These aren't hard questions to ask, but those are the questions that you should ask before you just accept something.
Question for you. Give me your five Hashgachas that you would rank as the five best Hashgachas.
I will never answer that question. No, it's good. I don't speak about other Hashgachas.
Well, what happens if our Rav says the same thing?
That's not it. I'll tell you, if somebody in my shul comes over to me and asks, I don't speak about other hashgachas, but if somebody in my shul comes over to me and asks me, I'm invited to eat at this hashgacha, could I eat? Or my wife wants to buy a certain product that has a certain hashgacha on it, I'll answer, because that's my achrayus as a rav. But as the OU, we can't speak about other hashgachas. We could speak about other hashgachas. You could ask me a question, does the OU accept ingredients from hashgacha X or from hashgacha Y? But I'm not rating them.
Okay, are there any of the major hashgachas in America who OU would not accept their ingredients?
I don't know who you consider the major hashgachas. I don't know.
Starkey, you accept?
Typically, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, typically, yes.
And the Hasidic Hechsherim, Nira Barta, et cetera, those you accept?
Typically, yes. Typically, you know, the word typically is important because sometimes, especially when it comes to meat. So meat, the OU only accepts OU certified meat. So when we're talking about meat.
You accept okay.
Again, typically, yes, but not on meat and wine. Things that are very complicated, we only accept our own hashgacha.
Interesting.
That doesn't mean that those hashgachas don't have other hashgachas on it. There are OU meat, OU chicken, OU wine that has other hashgachas, but we only will accept our own product. Or we checked it out independently.
Okay. Agresi Ashikaya, thank you so much.
Siris Tavis.
Bye-bye.
Okay, here's Rabbi Shlomo Pearl of the KCL talking about the reasons why a home of food production service needs a hechsher.
It's so important. There are not things that I can give you two reasons. First one is because when someone has a business in the house, it doesn't have a hechsher. So he's going to use the cheapest what he can use. Meaning, yeah, he's going to find an hechsher or something, but no one can tell him, listen, this is not approved. Our community doesn't use it. So why you give it to him? So only if you have an hechsher on top of them, the cashiers can tell him, this item is not approved. You cannot use it. I have an example, someone that call us for a hechsher, a business home. He makes some drink, and we find out he's using beef protein. And the beef protein was parv, meaning it's one of the hechsherim gives the hechsher on beef protein. He's not reliable, but no one. That's what I know. That's what I hear also. Not by the OU, not by the OQ, not by no one. But he is approving it. And it's also, he said, it's part of, even it's beef protein. And because it's made from bones in skin, whatever, he has his shit. But obviously no one approve it from the reliable actions. So this is enough a reason to people understand when you're going to use something that it's not with a reliable action. Everything could happen when we confront the guy. Listen, how you use it. This is you give it how you use it for Amish community. So he told me, "Ich weiß nicht, was a good action." It was a action, and somebody told me it's good. So I didn't know it's a problem. Wow, I don't know what to do now. Okay, so, and that's a lot, so ingredients is the main thing, and people also, Odom Bowl Al Momoino, he's gonna use the cheapest that he has, if no one is on top of him. And also, he doesn't know the halachas, what to watch, how to watch, and things that has to be, careful. Even it's Toiloim, even it's, Sakone, Chale, all around. So, yes, it's a very important thing. And the other thing, it's very important, even business that has Ashgocha, to make sure they have a combination lock number. Because, most of the time, even the places that have Ashgocha, it's very hard to get into the place. So we, the KCL, just not long ago, we sent an email for all, establishment and business owner that anyone must to put a combination lock number, and everyone change it to a combination lock number. Meaning the mashgiach is going to call before he goes just to make sure that he's not hoping that someone is inside. He's going to tell them, "Listen, I'm on the way to you. If someone is there, it's good. If not, someone is not there, he's going to open it and he's going to go inside and to check the whole place, all ingredients." So, Allegal Achas, important, people doesn't know. I heard a lot of people saying, like, there's a Elche Mensch, who's down as the Gualch. Right. But once you have a business, it's Arbe Chave Zurich. Yeah, Nida Scheune. Yeah, okay. It's amazing thing what you bring up, and it's very, very important. Yashay Koich.
Joining us from Flatbush is Rabbi Berach Steinfeld. He's the Rav of Dover Tov, which is on 24th and El Shul in Flatbush. He was for 20 years the Mashkiach for Kehillah Kashrus. That's basically the Flatbush Kashrus organization. And he's a Talmud of Torah Vadas. He's a Musmach of Rav Palm Zecher Tzadik Livracha and Rav Belsky Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Welcome, Rabbi Berach.
Thank you.
So, you see this all the time. I remember still when I was in the Yeshiva Samaria, and Gaman was trying to earn some money. His wife would bake cake, and he would put the cake on the table in the outside the door by the yeshiva, and you would pay Akasha 50 cents for a slice of cake, whatever it was. It was without any heksha. But you assumed that the young man learned in yeshiva, and, you know, in koil, etc., you know, he davened three times, seemed like a very little person, so we bought the cake. Were we doing the wrong or the right thing? There was no heksha on the cake.
So it's a very tough question to answer, and I'll revert back and say like this. Halacha Shachar says that every yid has a kashrus. So, be'etzem, I can eat in your house, you should be able to eat in my house, and trust me that whatever I serve you is 100% kosher.
Which is the halacha?
Yes. So how come we have the need for kashrus today? Every store has to have hashgacha, and it's accepted, and it's needed. So that's based on Chaim Tzanza, who felt and said that the minute you run a business and you're doing it to make money, then it's already a dina mama is bigadin, not an issa bigadin, and there you need edus, so to speak.
Okay, correct. But let me just back up. The Shulchan Aruch, who says that all you, and the Samachlek is Beis Yosef in the Ramah. The Beis Yosef says anybody, you don't even have to know he's a Muchzik B'Kashrus. Unless you know he's a Chashid, you can buy from his store.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ramah is more Machmir, like the Shita Sarambam. No, you need a Cheskes Kashrus. The Shulchan Aruch is talking about where it's a store. Right, it's not talking about in somebody's home. And yet, the Shulchan Aruch, even according to the Mohammed Dekadeya, says you don't need a Heksha. All you need is that the person should have a Cheskes Kashrus. I know the Beis Hill brings it in Sin Samachay from the Vadar Baratzis that notwithstanding the fact that the Shulchan Aruch says that you, even according to the Muhammad Dikadeh, at the most you need is somebody who's a Muchzik Bekashrus. The Lashon of the Beis Hill is, he says, Tiknu Bepinkas Hamadina of the Vadar Baratzis, Shalei Likach Shum Dover Meichel, Aum Kein Shiesh Beyade, Kosov Achosov Me'eza Av Bezdin Shinasa Behechsher. Why be Shum Loi Plug? Because, you know, it's going to happen. There's going to be a whole argument. He is a Muchzik Bekashrus. He's not a Muchzik Bekashrus. I saw he did daven. He davened in the wrong minion. He davened the wrong thing. He davened in a modern minion, a not modern. Whatever the case, he says, Loi Plug. Right, he says we need a cheskes, we need a muchzik b'kashrus, and I would imagine he's going on the Shulchan Aruch case, which is a commercial establishment, right?
So I'm going to add to what he says, if you don't mind, and
sure.
Explain it a little bit more, and explain why today it's imperative to have hashgacha. Once upon a time, we didn't have that many companies, we didn't have that many materials. A person would pretty much live in a shtetl, and they would have a sheikhet who shechts and a boydik who checks, and That's it. They would go every day or every once a week to shech the chicken and so on and so forth. Today, there is so much more involved in kashrus that it's virtually impossible even for one person to have the knowledge to know everything that's out there, if it's kosher or not. Because we have so many different materials that go into every product, whether it's preservatives, whether it's other things, vitamins and other things that go into every product, that it's virtually impossible for the layman even have a half a minute to know what's a Group A product and what's not a Group A product, what needs hashgacha, and to what extent does it need hashgacha. And there's so many intricate details that go into it. So
give us a few examples. What's a Grade A? What's a Grade B? I don't know what that means.
Okay, Grade A product would be like, let's say, sugar. Really does not need hashgacha. If it's just sugar and nothing else, it doesn't need hashgacha. But then you have products that like cereals or other things, which people think, yeah, it's pretty simple. It has wheat. It has a couple of items in it. But there's always that sneaky thing which is called natural and artificial flavors, which we don't know what those are, and you don't have to list them because they're less than 5% of the product. So we don't know what these things are unless you find out who, if the OU or somebody went into the plant and can verify what these things are. Is it a kosher product? Is it not? Et cetera, et cetera. So there's a bunch of things which we need today, more ideas and more help than once upon a time, as far as products go, as far as anything that's commercially packed. Then we have the problem of, let's say you have a line which can have kosher products and non-kosher products run on it. So you would need to have some sort of kashering mechanism, which we need to find out. Was it done? Was it a banyan? Was it not? Is it kasher with hagola? Is it kasher with fire? What exactly is being done to make sure? Is it an all parv plant? Is it not? Is it milk? Does it have milk? Is it chol v'sol? Is it not chol v'sol? There are so many intricacies that it's not like once upon a time you went to the farmer, filled up a bottle of milk, and that was that. So therefore, today, as a whole, we need to have hashgachas on all our products.
So here's my question for you. Okay. Can I eat in my friend's house knowing that there are so many different types of products?
L'chura, yes, because today your friend, I would imagine, knows that there's these issues and would have a certain guideline set for himself, whatever the guidelines are, without going into names of hashgachas, et cetera, that he accepts this hashgacha and this hashgacha he doesn't accept, and he only eats chol yisrael, or does not only eat chol yisrael, only eats pas yisrael, does not only eat pas yisrael, yashan, does not eat yashan. But I can go into his house and ask him, are you makbar on yashan? And if he tells me yes, and I'm makbar on yashan, I can trust him on it. But if
he says,
I don't know what yashan is, then I probably should not eat in his house.
So the question then is, let's say I know an Erlich guy has a store, right? So I walk into his store. Now, you mentioned that today we need hashgacha because it's complicated. Why can't I assume in his bakery he's only using OU products, he's only using Chassidish Hechsha Star K products, and based like I could eat in his house, I could eat in his store the same way?
That's a great question. So let me tell you the Dihava of the story, which will enlighten you a little bit. I worked, as I told you, for Kehillah for 20 years. And one of my places that we used to give hashgacha to was a store with multiple products. They ordered stuff and they sold it, and we would give hashgacha not for every particular product, but we'd make sure that every product is under hashgacha. And if it's a parv product, we would make sure that's an all parv plant, unless we made sure that hashgacha had a mashgiach kashering. We had certain guidelines set up. This owner was a chassidish yid, erel chayid, as far as I know, and I would still consider him an erel chayid. He would call me up sometimes and say, this and this product, could you do the research for me? Can I sell it in the store or not? I was once in the store with him straight there. This is why I'm saying this was in front of my eyes. And he asks me, I want you to find out about this product. But before you find out about this product, he opens up the package, he takes a bite out of it, and says, you know what? I'm not going to sell this in my store. This doesn't have good quality. But he ate it. So I asked him, Rav Yid, what's the shot? You ate this. You realize this could be paspalta, this could be chol stam. You ate this. He said, Hemachtzi. In my house, I would never bring any of this stuff in. I want my kids, Enikoch, to be Yireim or Shlema. This is business. I can't sell a product that's no good. I have to taste every product. Now, would you say he's an avarian? No. But when it comes to business, sometimes the best overtakes him in people that are in the business, and they have a separate standard when it comes to business, and then they have a separate standard when it comes to their house. Or you'll have people who say, in my
house... Which is interesting, Rabbi Rech, it's very interesting. And assuming that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't notice. Shulchan Aruch says, somebody's right. The Muslim... So you're saying that when the Beis Hill says that in a store, today we have a Heksha because of Loi Plug, you're saying it's beyond Loi Plug. It goes because when it comes to money, people often look the other way.
Unfortunately, they do. And I've seen this also in business. People eat out in places they would never bring in the same food into their own house. For some reason, when it comes to meetings and business and things like that, people all of a sudden start to be mental. I'm not sure why the HR is so prevalent.
Okay, so you're saying that is another svara to the Beis Hill, to be machmer, to need a hefshah.
It's a practical svara. Now let's back up to your original question.
Yeah, let's go back to now in the home.
The Shungaman, right, home-based business. I always feel that if this becomes a pure business where this lady is really going to make a business out of it, which there are some ladies with home-based businesses that became such big business that they themselves don't, it's not just like baking for a simcha or two or three, then they probably need hashkach. But if they're just baking, like you said, for Ingeman to bring a couple of extra dollars, the husbands are making good money or decent money, so maybe then... But again, you're going to say, we need a light plug. So that's why some people are not to have on the home-based business, a hashgacha, which in and of itself is a shverezach. I personally don't think that's our biggest problem, is the home-based businesses. I think the biggest problem is that, between you and me, if you walk into the guy's store and you cannot eat in the owner's house, then I don't care who the hashgacha is, you cannot trust it. Whereas if you have a person who you trust Ashgach, the owner, even if the Ashgach is not so great, as long as he has some sort of Ashgach with some sort of guidelines to help him out, to make sure that he is on the level of understanding that he shouldn't make any mistakes about certain products, you probably can trust him. It all starts and ends with the owner.
Well, the Shulchan Aruch says somebody who's a chashir on that zavar, you can't buy from him. You're adding on that even with a heksha, you can't buy from him because he'll figure out a way around the heksha.
Which we've seen.
Let's go back to the case.
Let's say Goyisha owner, right? There are people giving hashgachas to Goyisha owners. That's a big problem. We just saw what happened in Jersey,
that terrible thing that happened in Jersey based on that. But let me go back to the home.
Then they came out saying that you need home-based business, needs hashgachas. Their hashgacha messed up. A home-based business is not a Chinese person or a Goyisha person who's doing the business. So, if you want to be makta and kashrus and say the home-based business needs hashgacha, I'm all for it. But that should not be directly correlated to that story, which right after...
No, it's a daima. When you have a Yerushalayim baking at home, when you have a guy who's... The whole kashrus seems absurd.
It's been combined for some reason. Right after that story, they came out with cold cutters and all that thing against the home-based business, which they did nothing wrong.
Now, it's interesting. I see from the Asifas Yitzchak, he brings from Chaim Kinyevsky, who he was asked, if Yochel Lichter's mi Adam Shemuchsik Bekashrus, Afilum Eilu and Hechsher, and he says, Haminig de Bemuchsik Kainib. He writes that the Beis Hillel is not, it seems, the Minig of Klal Yisrael. Isn't that interesting? So let me ask you a question. The Kol Kaira came out, a bunch of Rabbanim, all home based businesses, need a Hashgacha. I've traveled around the world, right? I've been many places in the world, and you come to a town, you're in Singapore, Nafkamina, and you're hungry. So what do? You call Chabad. I don't know if they do this in Singapore. And the poor woman from Chabad, you know, they send them around the world. They send them with a nickel and you're a shamayim. They don't send them with any money. And they have to charge for the, when they send over to you, wherever you're staying dinner. They probably can't afford it. These younger light, they live by, a lot of them mamish live like a niya merudim, right? So somebody's going to say, look, this Chabad guy, his wife cooks suppers for travelers who are coming from America. They're in Tokyo or Japan or Hong Kong, wherever you're traveling wherever your business takes you. And now you're ordering from Chabad. They could never get him. How are you going to get a mashgiach in Hong Kong, right? So you're going to say, according to this Kol Kaira Luchar, you shouldn't be able to eat these dinners.
It's also because they themselves are the mashgiachim for a lot of the plant, these Chabad people. So you're going to trust them for the plant, but you're not going to trust them for the, what the Rebbetzin serves in their own house. Most of these Chabad people...
I understand, but it's hard to say... I understand, but so you're saying... Let's say the guy's not a mashgiach in another food. So you're saying, here we have a home-based business. The Chabad is baking bread and whatever it is, and shechting chickens, whatever, for people who come to town, and they charge them $20 for dinner. And we're going to say, you can't eat this dinner because they don't have a mashgiach, you know, according to this understanding, extension of the Beis Hillel into somebody's house. They're still talking about business, L'chaira. We're extending it and saying it to a home-based...
So can I just add to your point to drop, if you don't mind?
Yeah.
You're kind of preaching to the choir. Because let's say if the issue is money, right, and you're saying this Chabad woman who cooks in Singapore or in Tokyo, the problem is that she's getting paid for that meal, and that's why we're going to say she's a home-based business and she needs hashgacha. Let's say she would have hashgacha. That hashgacha would not do it for free either. They're also being paid. So why is the hashgacha taking money going to be better than this woman who sells a business and sells cake or cookies or meals in Tokyo for a living going to be worse?
You're asking in general, why am Hashgichim Neman, they're also taking money?
Correct. Every Hashgach is
okay,
taking money.
Okay, so, and the answer is?
And every Mashgiach, the answer is, Lemarim Masai. If you're a person that is, you're living and your job is to be a Mashgiach, you don't, and that's your expertise, and you spent years and years learning and studying, the last thing you want to do is mess it up over something stupid. Whereas when it comes to a Seicher who is selling hundreds of thousands of items, he might cut corners and say, you know what, in my house I wouldn't eat this, but you know what, it's really kosher. I'm just being machmir on myself. I'm going to add it to the list, and even though he doesn't know that maybe there's something more, there's a bigger problem with this item. Now, this woman in Tokyo who cooks, I'm sure she's not making a killing, and she has a very limited menu because she doesn't have much to work with. I'm sure she's not cutting corners, so we can understand, and that's the only thing that's around.
So wait, I don't understand. So you have a store that only has one product. You're going to say, since it's only one product, they don't need a hefsha?
Possibly. It depends what the product is. And depends if the product requires a bunch of different ingredients.
Let's say it's just making cake. They just make a chocolate cake. The store that just makes chocolate cakes. Would you say it doesn't need a hefsha?
Everyone's going to agree that the guy who used to deliver eggs didn't need a hefsha.
Yeah, but what's the shiloh with eggs? There's no shiloh.
There's tack enough shiloh because you can't even, there's no problem.
Nothing to do with eggs. What could you do with an egg?
But that's what I'm saying. So if this woman is cooking her meals, her standard meals, and she has very limited access to other stuff, then maybe shiitake doesn't need that.
Well, you could. So if you have a restaurant that has a simple meal, wouldn't need a hefsha?
No, a restaurant comes over.
So she's just a restaurant. She's a restaurant in small. That's what she is.
Do you think she has a bunch of goiters working there? Do you think she has a bunch of other people working there?
I would say that there's a difference between somebody's house and a store. And somebody's house, like you said, they don't want to trafe up their kalim. They don't want to trafe up their kitchen. So there's an extra stringency that somebody has in the house that they don't have in the store.
What about these women who have goiters working in the house, helping them?
Ain't simple, but you're allowed to eat in the house, right? So they're neman in the house.
They're neman for their own selves.
Yeah. Right. If a person's neman in their house, it's possible, there's a svara to say, I'm neman in my house. I don't want to trafe up my house. I don't want my goyita to trafe up my house. And therefore, you're allowed to buy from me without a hefsha. Right, which then becomes problematic. Why did the rabbanim require home hechsherim to have a...
I'll give an example. Even at home.
But I just want to...
Kosher. Yeah.
I would just say that there's a possibility, and it's fine as far as, but because this doesn't say in halacha anyway. The Beis Hillel just says you need a hechsher, period. He's machmir on the shach, on the taz, on the ramad, and he says you need it. And it makes sense, like you're saying. In a person's house, you're saying a person is more machmir. Therefore, in a person's house, we could say he doesn't need a hechsher. And they have all the Chabad guys, they're certainly muslik bakashras, they don't need a hechsher. You could say a home-based business does need a hechsher. So I would just say, this is just a svara to mechalik, a home-based business, that the pshat is, it's a separate kitchen, it's a separate thing, it's really sort of a business in your house. It's that same outside business that happens to be located in your house. When a person is cooking in their kitchen and they're cooking for themselves and they're also cooking to sell, that could be different than when somebody has in their house, like sort of a business in their house, which really has nothing to do with their...
The problem is also sometimes you could be cooking in your house and you'll cook for your house, everything will be milchiks, or everything will be parv, or everything will be fleshit. So you need a hashgacha to oversee, to make sure that if you're selling to the public, that they're selling, let's say a home-based lady who's baking cakes, you want to make sure that that cake can be eaten with fleshiks and can be eaten with milk. You want to make sure she kashas her oven between one and the other at home. She may not do that. She may say, forget it, I'll eat it only with fleshiks. I'll eat it only with milkiks, and she'll keep track of it. But once it goes out of the store, she's not going to label it, this was cooked in the milkig oven, together with milkiks, together with cheese that is running, or not, or whatever it is. So there is intricacies which even a home-based business could use the help of a hashgacha. I don't think it's required. I don't think it's mandatory. It's probably recommended, if you want to be on the safe side, to discuss it and to have a hashgacha help you out, make sure you run a kitchen that it's 100% parv, that you can sell to everybody, to both milchiks and fleishiks. If you see what I'm
okay.
saying.
Okay, let me go.
Even though it's
okay.
kosher. Okay.
No. You're saying that if it's a complicated kashrus process, you should discuss it with a mashgiach to make sure you're getting it right, regardless of whether you need a hechsher or not.
Correct.
Okay, here's a question. There are hundreds of hechsherim. How do you know which are good and which aren't good? We know, there's a few sort of the super hechsherim that they're good. And then afterwards, how do you know if a hechsher is good? And I want to ask you in particular, let me ask you something that you now have your own hechsher, so I don't want to start up with you personally, but it used to be that the hashgachas were not for profits. What does that mean? They were big organizations, they were sort of like the OU, or I guess the Star K, they're owned by the Kehillah, that they're not for profit, the money is, and therefore if they have to lose a client, okay, it's not their money, it's sort of the Kehillah's money, they're doing what's right for the community, period. Today you have all these hasherim that have become privately owned businesses. Right?
That's a great question.
And how do we trust these hechsherim, these private family-owned businesses that they make millions and millions, they fly in their private jets, like, do they really want to lose a client? How do we do that?
But I want to tell you something. Your logic is great in theory, but let's say I worked for Kehillah, which is also an organization, also an organization which is non-profit. None of the Rabbanim of Kehillah make a penny, and they give up their time for it. There's a few mashgichim who make money. But to say that they're not scared of losing a client, maybe the upper Rabbanim are not scared. But if I'm a mashgich and I work for a caterer, okay, and I'm hired by, let's say, the OU to be a mashgiach for a certain job. And if I catch something by that caterer and I lose my job, I'm not guaranteed to get another job. You realize that?
Look, it's for sure that there are going to be situations in any set of rules that go against the general rule, right? But as a rule, not for profits are not concerned about profits, and for profits are concerned about profits.
I'm sorry for arguing, but I'm not concerned about profit. If your payroll is a certain amount, even if you're not a profit, you still got to cover payroll. And if you have people working in a big organization, you don't want to lose people.
It says
with any hashgacha,
it's true, Rebbeirach, but
don't want to lose.
It's true.
One or two, they don't care, but they definitely don't want to lose the bulk of their hashgacha.
Rebbeirach, it's true that everybody is worried about making payroll. There's no doubt about it, right? So it's all in degrees. A for-profit is very driven. Their purpose is to make money, right? A not-for-profit is to ply the service. They happen to need the money to cover their overhead. So it's a very different mindset. So we're not saying nobody that they don't care about money at all. Like the sine betza, they don't want money. They have to make payroll. They made commitments for the year. They rented a place to oversee police work, right? But the bottom line is they're driven by a purpose, and the money is secondary. And the for-profit is driven by the money, and the purpose is secondary. That's how every for-profit and not-for-profit in the world works, right?
So I'll just tell you what the difference is. The difference is when you're setting guidelines and when you're setting standards. So if you're a not-for-profit organization, then you're totally a lot in people who donate money to you. And therefore, to a certain extent, you have to service them. So your guidelines and your setup of how you want things run may be on a lesser scale than someone who opens up the hashgacha and says, look, I'm going to keep to certain guidelines no matter what. And I'm also going to make money. Now, the money-making issue is a problem regardless. That's a problem, and the best case scenario would be is, like you said, that you would have a kehillah hashgacha, the mashgich would get paid by the kehillah, doors wouldn't even have to pay for hashgacha, they would pay a minimal fee to the kehillah, and that's it. Like KJ tried over the years, and there were hashgachas that tried that, even kehillah tried that, but it's not sustainable. Unfortunately, we're living in a society where this would not be sustainable. In the best case scenario, you're 100% right. It would be great if everything would be non-for-profit, and everybody would just answer to the rabbanim, and every mashgich would be as and know that he cannot be hired or fired by the store he works for. It doesn't happen today.
So do you believe that not-for-profit hashgachas are better than for-profit, or you don't think there's a difference?
In theory, yeah, but I don't think there's a difference now. Because ultimately, the guy on the front line, the mashgiach that's in the store, that's not high up there as an RC. An RC is not worried about his job, but the small mashgiach who runs in, works, takes a shift in a restaurant, or the small mashgiach who takes a shift by a caterer, he's very worried about his job.
Okay. How do you know if a hechsher is good or not?
So I really don't have a great answer for that. All I could say is, in Pirkei Avos it says, say lecha rav, you have to find a rav who you ask your shaylos to. And don't go shopping for a rav. This rav will say, this hashgacha is good. And I go to the other rav who says, this hashgacha is good. You stick to your rav and make sure your rav is well-educated. And he will know which hashgachas are good, which are not. There are rabbanim out there that know hashgachas. And there are, you could ask them, and they will give you an unbiased opinion. But you're right. It's very hard to know when you have so many symbols out there. I myself have to go and certain hashgachas that are coming from really out of town, from other countries, to find out what level or what standards they have, and I have to talk and make phone calls and have to try to find out.
So what standards does a kashrus organization need to have to be able to rely on them?
You need to have a mashgiach to see if there's kashrus that needs to be done. If there's fish, you need to make sure. If there's filleting of fish, you need to make sure there's a mashgiach. Constantly your stuff is under lock and key. If there's any cooking done, you need to make sure there's a mashgiach to turn on the fires, or at least, at worst, have someone light the fires via remotely. Making sure that you're not doing in the same plant milking some fleshik without hashgacha tmidis when it comes to kashering. Another issue is if you kasher chocolate, let's say chocolate machines with chocolate, the Moshe held you can't kasher chocolate with chocolate, you have to have chocolate machines to kasher with water. There are loads of things which you need to have standards when it comes to hashgachas. And these are all questions you must ask the hashgachas themselves, what their standards are, or the rabbanim have to ask, and then they can advise their constituents.
Well, Rebbe, thank you very much for your time.
Hatzlacha,
bye-bye. Hi, it's Moshe Cohen. I'd like to give my answers to this week's riddle. The first question was on the Dazim Avir, and why would the Zecha go out if they chose to stay in Mitzrayim? So what the standard answer people say is that they didn't chose to stay in Mitzrayim. They were, somehow they got stuck there, and they wanted very much to leave. And in fact, there was a Midrash that there was a special Kriyas Yamsuf in the Chloidom. They wanted to leave, and when they law, they weren't the cloud, all those who died, because all those who died were people who wanted to stay in Mitzrayim. If you chose to stay in Mitzrayim, you got to stay. Not alive, but dead. Those who wanted to leave were very few, and Dostal Avirim was among them. So even though Pare later on spoke to them, that was because they were, but they really wanted to leave, and that's why they weren't the cloud. Legufay Shalashayla could be, it sounds like a deichik. I would say that it's very hard to know Darkei Hashem. Maybe they had a good grace of Zeda maybe their families needed them very much in the Midbar, and if they wouldn't be there, it would be a tremendous loss for their families. And the Baruch Shalom had Rachmanis on them and let them leave, even though they wanted to stay in the Mitzrayim. So it's true, as a general rule, those who wanted to stay stayed, and those who wanted to leave left. But there were Yetzim and Klal, people that took them, they had Chusavis, maybe they did some type of mitzvah, which they deserve to be paid back in this world for. It's hard to know these things. So that would be my answer to these types of questions. The Torah doesn't really tell us, and it's very hard to know Cheshbein HaShemayim. The second question was about Aniva Malach, Aniva the Shliach. Rav Kiva Eger, as is well known, says that there were two Bechiris. The Bechar of the Av was Aniva Shavchanti Betipa, Shabachar of Tipash, and the Bechar that was done by the Baruch Shalom himself, because only the Baruch Shalom knew. The other Bechiris, the Bechar of the Aim, the God Labayis, that was through a Sarah, through a Mechabo, a Mashkis. So that was the Mashkis, which wasn't led into their house. It could be, even when we say the Baruch Shalom went down, so the Baruch Shalom Shechina was Shira, but the Baruch Shalom didn't himself go ahead and kill. The Baruch Shalom has no Gashmias, he's no Tzuras Haguf. And to suggest that the Baruch Shalom interacts with the physical world on a literal level brings us into questions of Hagshama. So there was some type of Mashkis, which the Baruch Shalom used. It wasn't that the Baruch Shalom just sent out a Malach while he stood from afar. No, the Baruch Shalom himself went down. And somehow was closer to this world than he usually is, but there still was a Mashkis. So since there was a Mashkis, there was a Mokin for something to happen. So there still needed to be a Shmir. That would be my answer.
Yeah, I just wanted to answer the two questions from this week. The first one was, why it sounds like it's a stira if my Bechiris was Bechidei Ba'atmei or it was Ayidea Mashchit, and that's why they couldn't be Yotze from their bias, because Me'achashanit Nerushas Lamashchit Bechabel Einam Asamim Tadik LaRosha. So that was the stira in Rashi, so you could answer. And Rashi really fears that Laila Rishus LaMechablam Hu Shnema Baitim Is Kochei Teyora. So it would seem like from Rashi, and the Ramban also points it out, that it's not the reason why it was Nit the Rishus LaMashchus LaChabo is nothing to do with the actual Makkah. The Makkah, maybe the Ramban says that Rashi is that really Mitzad the Makkah, it was Bechvedu Ba'atma. So you couldn't say it's Mitzad the Makkah. It's just it's Tamadim that you any night you shouldn't leave your house because it's Laila Rishas LaMechablamu, and really it's the Gemara, and really that's the way the Mechelta finishes off, and it's also a Gemara in Bava Kamma that darshans from this pasuk nothing to do with any Makkah, darshans that you should Lailam, person should be Yaitan from the ear. The chita is that you should go when it's daytime. So, and that's learned out of this pasuk. That's nothing to do with the makkah. And the Ramban points that out. And this is so the Masha answers the Ramban taina. The Masha and Bava Kamma there answers the taina that that it was nothing to do with the makkah. That's for that question. The other question about why Dasam Avirim were not killed during Chayshech, you could say this is a medrash that says that when the Klai Yisrael were complaining in the Midbar, that Habim Farim Harit Mitzrayim, that they should die in the Midbar. So that part of the taina was that the people who, it says in the Medrash, that the people who were died during Chayshech had Tura and Hesped, Shal Chazay. And they were expected to die in the Midbar without any Tura, without any Hesped. Maybe the reason why they didn't die was because they didn't deserve Tura and Hesped. So that's why they died Ba'adat Kairach, and they were just swallowed up without any real Tura and Hesped. And Pakarat, it was not a Hesped, but they were Hudas and Ba'avirim that were Nivlu Ba'adat Kerech, the Pasuk says. So they shouldn't have that covered. Okay, bye-bye.
Hello, this is Siakam Koenigsberg. I wanted to give an answer to the riddle. There's a Pella in the day from the Eremai and Chaim and Pachim Mishal coming up. He wants to say that says Bnei Yisrael, Hochul Miyab Hashem Tzech Hayom Miyot Rabim Mishnayim. He wants to say that on Ashnayim Yisrael Levan Nikra Hayam Behim Nosan Vavirom. We see that Nosan Vavirom got their own Kriyas Yamsuf at the Pella. So why would they Zeichet to such a thing? Achoinim are Mazbir that after they heard about the Nisim HaGdolim by Kriyas Yamsuf, it was Nichnas Libam Herhuri Tshuva. Or, I heard many years ago that from that Nashmayim, they didn't want to drown, and they have to be doing a lot of different things. The Rosh Taka asks his Kasha, he says, why didn't they Taka die? He says that they were not in Tziyai Shumin Agulach. You see, a Pel Dikazach, that even though they were so richos, but they were not in Tziyai Shumin Agulach. And they wanted to Taka leave in time. I heard once also that Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted them around to here with the Taka leave over in the Mon and different Zachen that had to be done during the devise a lot of different Kiddush Hashem things that they were in the Midbar. On the second riddle, the Ritzpo asks Kasha, the Ritzpo says that Malach, he wants to say Akavon al HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Kiva Eger, he wants to say that there's a hill between a Machar Me'av and Machar Me'a'im. And Machar Me'av, no, you can't be Mafchin. So that was done by the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem came Machar Me'im, that it's Hukar and Vor L'Kol, that was done by the Shliach. On Sefer's Mavor and Chavis Chuvis, I want to say that Makas Acharis was Nishlam Aide Malach. It was Nishlam. It was Alpid in the Sach Smachas, Mavor and Akadosh Baruch Hu started off and then made him into the Garden. People that were in the Farfar, and they were. So he says that Akadosh Baruch Hu was Matish the Krech Mabo Kle, and a Malach came and cleared it out. The Rashbat and other ones say that the Malach that we're talking about is Michal. He didn't come to go and take them out. He was just advising what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted, and he pulled it over to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's Kenim Malach HaTezis, like it says, that it means the Gam Malach, that anything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is with the Zama with the Malach. So I go again, you should have a Sloha and Brocha, and you have a Zakadish.